I'm Judy Stewart and this is Unpaused, a podcast for women wanting to reinvent a career or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. Today I'm speaking to retired Australian Family Court Justice Michelle May. Michelle's is a story with a great twist. She grew up in Brisbane, an only child, raised by a professional working mother. Unusual for those times, she spent a year in the US on a Rotary scholarship, which enlarged her worldview considerably, Brisbane having not quite shrugged off its reputation as just a large country town. She came back, studied law, and established a practice at the bar in her early 20s. From that time on, with one spectacular exception, she never really stopped. I'll let Michelle tell you about her working life in her own words, but by way of introduction, she recently retired from the bench after a 40-year career. Firstly at the Family Court Bar, later as a Queen's Counsel in that jurisdiction. At 40, she accepted an appointment as a judge in the trial division of the court, and 8 years later stepped up to its Court of Appeal. Amidst all this professional success, her career took the most dramatic of turns when at 35, she gave birth to triplet daughters, thus the pause. More on that later. I particularly wanted to invite Michelle to come on air as I thought she would know more than most, having directly observed in the divorce courts what women sometimes do in their personal lives, which ultimately has the effect of sabotaging their careers or their lives more generally. We have certainly seen a spectacular example of that in Australian politics, with a female premier forced to disavow a relationship with threats to pierce her reputation for integrity. So it seems all the more timely to talk about it now. Michelle, welcome to Unpaused.
Thank you very much, Judy.
If you look back over your career, what do you think was the best phase?
I think I enjoyed the bar the most. I really loved being an advocate. And so it was quite difficult to give that up and take the judicial appointment. I love being in chambers, including with your husband and other really terrific people that have remained lifelong friends. So I think professionally that was the happiest time of my life.
I think you do have a talent for friendship, Michelle. I see the bar as being both collegial and competitive. Mm. How did you manage that dynamic? Because you've come out of it with lots of lovely friends who must have been quite aggressive opponents at times.
Well, I think that what you say is quite right. And certainly in my early years at the bar, I found the competition a bit difficult to cope with, especially from the younger men who would come in and circle around my room looking at what work I had and then comment that I didn't seem to have as much work as they did. After a while, I realised that just wasn't true. But with the support of other barristers, I, after a while, didn't worry too much about the competition and just got on and did my own work.
I want to start really by talking about your mother, because she was such a wonderful woman, and I know she was a very big figure in your life, both on the domestic front but also as a mentor. Can you tell me a little bit about her background and her life?
She was an extraordinary person. She went to, as I did later, St. Margaret's School, which I don't think they quite understood how clever Mummy was at that stage. She was outstanding at sport and a great ballerina. So she finished grade 12 and then went to Melbourne and joined what was then the Borovansky Ballet School, which was later the Australian Ballet. And she danced there for many years, and then realised that her options were either to go to Covent Garden and see if she could become a principal dancer or something else. And she decided, based on speaking to other girls who'd gone to London but really hadn't been terribly successful, that it was time for her to change course. So she came back to Brisbane and she wanted to do physiotherapy, which of course was a university course. And she hadn't done chemistry or physics. And so she had to go to Hubbard's, which I think might still exist, to do chemistry and physics. And my mother was an extremely attractive woman. And when she arrived there, the man who was the head of Hubbard's said to her he really didn't think she should bother doing chemistry and physics. It was highly unlikely that she would finish the course.
So how old would she have been by then?
I think about 22.
So older than a lot of others at Hubbard's.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, she did extremely well and then did physiotherapy, which she really was very interested in, and worked as a physio and then later on taught at university.
And she was very sort of, she was around though, wasn't she? I remember when I first knew you at uni, she was around and about. She got to know all your friends and made it her business to be present but not hovering.
She loved being with young people and she really enjoyed teaching. which was a predominantly female profession in those days, and she really enjoyed teaching the young women.
Michelle, I've heard you say before that St. Margaret's, even in your day, wasn't particularly a great crucible for the career woman. That wasn't a school that really encouraged women to think about the professions. Was it your mother who would have really pointed you in that direction?
Yes, I think so. I think it was absolutely dreadful. No one spoke to us at school about what we might do later on. It was almost a training ground for young women who inevitably would marry, and that would be their whole lives. I still talk about that to some of the other girls I went to school with, and it was a great shame because some of those girls really could have done a great deal more, I think, than what they actually did.
Was it your mother who... It was quite a big leap to go and do law. So was she very determined that you have a career?
Yes, she was. I don't think she cared really what I did. I don't think she had a strong view that I should do law. I guess to some extent it might have been a question of elimination. I wasn't very good at maths, physics and chemistry, as she was, and so therefore I wasn't going to do medicine, and quite a few people in my family are doctors. But she certainly expected me to go to university. There was no doubt about that.
To go on and work as hard as you worked, Michelle, I mean, you know, I've said to you, you're the hardest worker I know. You've never really had a break. You must have been quite driven as well.
I don't think I worked terribly hard at university. I had a lot of fun at university, which you might remember.
And when you could in those days too.
Yes.
It wasn't as full on as it is now.
Well, there was no, apart from people like Pat Keane, there was no real imperative to do enormously well because we all knew we'd get jobs, and in those days it was relatively simple. So we just had to get through. But also some of the teachers were dreadful. Absolutely terrible. The law school was an appalling place, so there were really only a few good lecturers. I had this strong feeling from quite a young age that I wanted to be a barrister.
And so you went to the bar, you married Charles, who was considerably older than you.
That's right.
Was he 10 years?
Yes, he's 10 years older
Which was a lot when you're 25 and he's 35.
It was. Look, I could almost say it was an arranged marriage. I was going out with somebody when I was a student, and then when I first started working for later Justice Hellman. And I have to say he wasn't very keen on the fellow I was going out with at the time, and did his best to make sure that Charles came for cups of tea as often as possible. And I was really quite nervous about Charles because he was a real grown-up. And
was he a silk by then?
No, he was still a junior barrister. And he was very good-looking, and I was really quite nervous around him, I think. Anyway, the time came for me to leave the judge and go to the bar, and I said, oh, I must find a pupil master. And I had a couple of ideas, and he said, no, the best person for you is Charles Brabazon. And I said, I couldn't possibly ask him. Oh, no, yes, look, I'll mention it to him. Yeah. So really, I attribute to some extent my marriage to John Hellman.
Well, it's been a very successful marriage, so he was a good pickup.
He was.
So you got married. You had two big careers going in sync at home. That must have been quite a challenge.
Well, it was a bit of a challenge.
I mean, he's got briefs, you've got briefs. He's in court, you're in court. Mm-hmm. It's high pressure when you're in court. You know, you've got a trial on. There's a lot of staying up late, getting up early.
That's true. I suppose I was junior to him too, but my reaction to work was different from Charles. Charles was an extraordinarily hard worker. He'd always leave home at 7 o'clock in the morning and be home at 7 o'clock at night, and just work hard all day.
So 10 years on, around about,
yes,
you had the girls, the three girls.
That's right.
In one day.
In one day.
Yeah. So tell me about that.
I had a very successful practice primarily in family law, and Charles had taken silk and he was very busy. And, you know, I don't mind saying we tried for years to have these children. Unfortunately, science eventually helped us and we had three at once. Charles was initially very annoyed with the doctor about that because he was quite worried about my health and the health of the children. But fortunately, they were all born well children. We were very lucky. So it was a huge shock because Charles had never had anything to do with children at all. I don't think he'd ever even picked up a baby. And as an only child, I'd had very little to do with children. So it was a big difference in our lives.
Michelle, I just can't, even now, having known you for as long as I've known you, I still can't imagine how you actually manage three babies at once.
Well, I guess one just has to.
I mean, you really need two parents on deck all the time, don't you?
Yes. Well, we had a lot of help, and I guess that's my answer to it. We were very fortunate that Charles was very busy at work, and so we could afford to have a lot of help, plus my mother.
And your mother was amazing, wasn't she?
She was absolutely amazing. She still had several practices as physio, and two of them were nearby, so she would often pop in the morning and she'd come in the afternoons. And little by little, she sold the practices and was really just around full time.
Do you think that maybe when they were little, like really tiny, that in a way it's sort of easier in terms of getting your career back on track? Because if they're with someone, they're with them. They're not wandering around. So that in terms of leaving them during the day.
I think that's right. I had a wonderful housekeeper who'd worked for me for a long time and a very experienced nanny. So when I did go back to work, I could just walk out the door and I wasn't worried about them.
And did your mother sort of check on them during the day?
Oh, yes.
So you went back to work after a year. You had 1 year off. And did you ever think at that time that you might stop?
No. No, I had no interest. Not because I didn't like being with the children, but I didn't think it was necessary.
Did you never sort of think, though, that maybe the juggle would be so gigantic that it would just be too hard?
Not really, because I really didn't regard it as a choice.
Yeah.
I really thought that it was best for everyone for me to go back and go back into practice. Not full time. I worked about 3 days a week and then 4 days a week. And then Charles and I spent all the weekends with the children. That was the only thing that perhaps might have been a bit difficult. We had very little social life.
It was all about the kids. Well, that's normal.
It was.
And what about the chambers that you went back to? So you kept your chambers, you paid your rent for the year that you were
off. I had somebody else use my room for a year.
Okay. Yeah. And then you just went back. And was there any resistance there at that end?
No, I think they were quite pleased to see me.
Well, that's good. Was there one thing that you think that you and Charles did really well that was the thing that the kids might remember that you felt that you really did well as a parent?
I think we worked as a team quite well. There was never really any disagreement between us about how we should bring up the children. We had the same attitudes and ideas. We understood that they were different human beings, that they needed to be treated as individuals.
Because they weren't identical in any sense, so completely different.
Completely different. It was quite a lot of work, but we made sure that they were all treated as individuals. They had their own friends. They had their own activities.
So you then took Silk, which must have been quite a big thing to do, but I suppose were you just so busy that you really had to sort of go to that next level?
Look, I was very busy, and it wasn't actually my idea. It was the idea of some of the family court judges who said, we'd like you to take Silk and we'll support you.
And is that because there were no female Silks in Queensland at the time?
Yes, probably. They probably thought it was time that someone was a family law Silk. So Susan Kiefel, of course, had taken Silk before me.
The current Chief Justice.
Yes. Yeah. There were very few women Silks and certainly none in the family law jurisdiction.
And did you feel that you wore that mantle of being the first mover as a woman in Brisbane? Did that ever weigh heavily on you where you sort of thought, look, I've really got to make this work?
No.
You never did?
No, not really. I mean, I realised it was important and I realised there are a lot of responsibilities that go with taking Silk. You know, you're meant to show some leadership responsibilities and I certainly did that. I took over running the family law bar section and all sorts of other things, gave lots of speeches. So I took that part seriously. But I don't think I was particularly troubled by the fact that I was the first woman.
I suppose you didn't have time, quite frankly. I mean, I don't know how you did it, Michelle.
I think there is a bit of self-indulgence. People go on about, I'm the first person doing this. And if you're qualified to do it, well, that's really all that matters.
But Michelle, I mean, I'm not going to let you off the hook here. Let's say it's a Wednesday and you're in court starting a trial. You're a Silk, so it's a big matter. You've got a junior in tow. There's a very anxious client, a crotchety judge. Somebody's been sick overnight, you know, as children are. You've hardly had any sleep, honestly, Michelle. There must have been days where you thought, oh my God, how am I going to do this?
There were. There were days I felt incredibly tired. There were days when I got things like chicken pox, whooping cough. So certainly there were struggles.
But I suppose it's all a blur now, is it?
It is a bit of a blur.
The girls have all gone on to have careers of their own.
Yes.
So one's a lawyer.
Yes.
One's an equine vet. Nearly. And the third one...
Is an army officer.
Oh, that's right. So she's in the army.
Yes. She's a captain.
Well done. I mean, you know, no one ever says well done, Mum. Do you think it's a good time now to be a working woman?
Yes, I do. Well, some things are easier. I mean, I can still remember my mother on Saturdays having to rush around and do the shopping because all the shops closed at 12. I mean, that seems extraordinary now, doesn't it?
Those things make it much easier. But in a professional sense, especially in the family court, all the prejudice, etc., has just melted away?
I think so, yes.
And what about from the client's perspective? How do they feel about having a woman? Or is it that women prefer to have women, or men are relaxed about having women represent them?
I think men are fairly relaxed about that. Certainly there are some women that say they would rather have a woman represent them. And I can understand that, because they feel that perhaps, especially talking to a young man, he really wouldn't know what she was talking about.
No. I want to get on to the observations that you've been able to make and the perspective that you must have now about how women who are otherwise very competent in their lives sometimes make decisions in their personal lives that sort of effectively sabotage their ambitions. What have you seen women routinely do that, knowing what you know now, you'd counsel them to do otherwise?
Well, I think the first mistake people make is choosing the wrong partner. We've all seen that happen. And some people don't learn from their mistakes and repetitively choose similar people. And there's probably some good reasons, if you were a psychiatrist or psychologist, why people do that. It's not just a lack of confidence, but it's probably something to do with their childhood. But the first thing to do is to choose the right partner. And if you haven't chose the right partner, get out of it rapidly and hopefully do better the next time. Don't hang around thinking you're going to improve someone.
No.
Because generally that won't happen.
No, I've recently interviewed a young woman, Emily Brooks, who wrote a book on this very subject about women turning themselves into something else to make themselves more desirable to a man rather than bringing their whole self and often very hard-won achievements to a relationship. They pretend they're someone that they're not in order to sort of dumb down their image and dial up their desirability. I mean, you must have seen that quite a lot.
I think it's true that it is difficult for very successful women to have stable long-term relationships. I think there are some men that feel challenged by that. And I think those women often find themselves confused and choose the wrong person.
What about financially, Michelle? Because a very big part of your role as a judge was to, it's not just about the marriage breakup and it's not just about the children, as often as not, it's really about the property as well. What mistakes have you seen women make where they could so easily make better decisions?
Well, I suppose the classic one is women just not involving themselves in financial decisions that are made during the relationship and saying, oh, look, I'm too busy looking after the children and everything else, I'll just leave it all to him. And when the relationship falls apart, they actually have no idea about what their financial circumstances are. And that leads them to usually suspect that there's more money than there is and spend a lot of money on lawyers finding nothing, or just generally feeling that they've got no control over the situation.
And in your world, is that talked about a lot in terms of reform and public policy and public conversations?
It's talked about a little bit in the context of discussing an analysis of contribution people make in a marriage and what that means in a financial sense for property settlement orders. There was quite a famous case a little while ago where these people had been married for a long time. They had three children, but by the time it came to court, they were in their early 70s. So her contribution of bringing up the children had long ago ceased. And the husband's argument, who was a rich man, was, well, she's made very little contribution. If you look at the whole of our married life, only a third of it did she do anything. She brought up the children, but for the last two thirds, she did nothing. And I'm happy to say the full court didn't accept that argument and said, well, this is how they'd chosen to arrange their lives. She'd continued to run the household, entertain some of his friends, and supported him in his business life. But women can be extremely vulnerable in those circumstances. I think it is hard sometimes for women because men can be quite aggressive about insisting that they make all the decisions about money. So it should really be a red flag when men say things like that to women.
I do think, though, that from my observation, men do talk amongst themselves about money-making ventures, for better or worse. It's part of their conversation, isn't it? Whereas in a way, culturally, perhaps it's not part of ours.
I think that's true. It's regarded as being poor taste for women to discuss money.
Yeah, but maybe the younger generation are more switched on to that.
They might be. They probably talk a bit about what they do and money they're earning. But no, I think you're absolutely right. There still is a bit of a gender thing about money, that women shouldn't really talk about money so clearly.
And Michelle, what about the other part of the job? It does involve managing the care and custody of children of a relationship that's broken down. which must be very difficult, especially having three children of your own. You understand better than most how acute that agony must be. Do you often feel that it's an impossible choice? Were you often criticised for the decisions you made?
I think in the early years when I went to the court, it was more difficult in the sense that often we saw two capable parents who had just separated and couldn't agree, and there was some difficulty deciding who the children should live with. In time, it became less difficult because more and more now the disputes about children involve parents who have serious drug and alcohol abuse. So many judges are now left in the situation of looking around to think, well, who can these children be placed with? Because both parents are unsuitable.
So when you say serious drug and alcohol abuse, what does that look like? Like, how do they present?
That means they're people that often are really incapable of looking after their children because of the drugs and alcohol that they consume, and combined with family violence.
So what do you do? You're sort of casting around for a grandparent?
Or, as the judges, well, I've often heard them say, the least worst alternative for the children.
Now, I want to talk about diversity on the court. What do you think that women judges bring to the court that maybe was absent before?
I suppose women that have had children themselves might have a better understanding of the needs of children. But that's not to say that a lot of male judges don't understand the needs of children. There's been some wonderful male judges who really were particularly good at parenting cases. Women might be more attuned to what you've been talking about, and that is the juggling of all these different roles. So when there's an argument about, well, the woman stopped contributing anything when the children grew up, one of my friends that I sat with on that particular case said to the barrister, so what should this woman have done? So I suppose women are more attuned to the difficulties of what can women do when they've made various choices.
I know this is a difficult proposition, but do you give counsel from the bench? Do you give them advice?
Yes, as a trial judge. Trial judges do, certainly not as an appeal judge. But as a trial judge, maybe hearing interim things, not so much a final hearing, interim cases, you might say, no, look, I'm going to decide that the children come and see their father every Saturday and Sunday. I know you want more time with the children, but let's see how you go.
You did it for a long time, Michelle, 40 years, to sort of be witnessing basically the breakup of established norms across society. When you retired, what was your overall sense? Were you optimistic or pessimistic? Are we going into better times, or do you think it's just getting harder and harder to be in relationships, parent? What do you think?
I think it is harder. I really do. And as I said before, it's the drugs and alcohol and the family violence is the real change. I mean, it's very hard to know how much of that was happening in the past because people that weren't married didn't have a court to go to have decisions made about their children. So goodness knows what happened to them. And then fortunately all that changed. So no matter what relationship their parents are in, they can come to the family court. But we noticed an enormous change over the years of the incidence of family violence and drug and alcohol abuse.
Did you ever feel exposed yourself in terms of security?
Only twice I felt nervous about someone. There was one man I said that he could never see his children again, and he was an extremely violent man. And I was a bit worried about him. And one day he turned up and just sat in the back of the court and stared at me. And I really felt a bit nervous about that. And another day I had a woman who was very unstable, and I'd seen her a few times. And finally the day came where the inevitable had to happen and she wasn't going to see the children anymore. And she got up and grabbed a glass off the bar table and came running towards me. And I had a terrific court officer, a man who'd served in Vietnam. He still knew how to move, and he grabbed her and tackled her.
Right.
But she was very unwell.
Michelle, it's been an amazing experience, hasn't it? You're a very sophisticated person, but you sort of, there's that very raw edge to the work that you do. Mm. Isn't there?
Oh, there is. The children's cases are certainly the hardest. You know, dividing up people's money is complex in the sense of legal principles, but really is it very troubling emotionally.
If I turn to the premise of Unpause, which is about women who've taken an extended break and are looking to get themselves back to work. You must have seen this. I mean, a lot of women, when they break up, have suddenly got to reinvent their careers. Any worldly wisdom to add to that?
Well, it's terribly hard for them, especially those women who thought that they were financially very well off, and as it turns out, more money is owed than they ever expected. So they find themselves living in a much smaller house with very little money to live on, and their whole world is, the rug's been pulled out from under them. It's very difficult. But that's why women should make sure that they have some sort of education in the first place so they can do another job.
And get that financial security.
Absolutely.
Have some control and yes. some access to funds.
To support themselves and also to support their children. It's really humiliating, I think, for women to find themselves in the position where the children are being financially supported 100% by their husbands. So even though the children might predominantly live with the women, they know that, and the children know, that it's the father that's really still handing out the money. And that leads to power and control. And it's sad for women to feel that they haven't even got enough money to buy their children something or take them on holiday or those sort of things, that it's only the father that can do it.
I've been very affected by the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the way that she and her husband were able to juggle two careers and give and take at different times of their careers. And she's certainly one of my heroes. I wondered if you have any legal or other heroes. Is there someone who's always been a bit of a guiding light for you?
Well, I'm happy to say Susan Kiefel, as you said, the Chief Justice, is a great friend of mine, and she's outstanding, absolutely outstanding person. She's a wonderful person to have as a friend. I think we all know what she did about the Dyson Heydon revelations in recent times. I think that was extremely brave of her. She led the court in that, saying, as she did, various things, including, we are ashamed that this has happened in the High Court, was an extraordinarily powerful thing to say.
So what was happening was, it's been alleged that one of the High Court judges was sexually harassing the young female associates. And to be an associate in the High Court, you have to have an incredible academic record and demonstrate a lot of promise in the profession. And basically, when these girls were abused, they departed the profession, one of them at least.
One of them did.
Departed the profession forever. So Susan Kiefel, being the Chief Justice of the court, took a position to investigate any allegations that may not yet surfaced.
It was investigated by somebody who has real experience and understanding of how to investigate these things, and the report was provided to the Chief Justice. Now, I know that one argument is, oh, this man hasn't gone to trial. It's terrible to suggest that he must have done it. But quite frankly, the fact that so many of these outstanding young women who hadn't colluded about this, who little by little it came out, they hadn't spoken to each other, made these allegations, I don't know that there's much doubt. And so what the Chief Justice did, instead of saying, oh, well, we'll have to leave this to criminal courts or leave this to others, we mustn't say anything, she made a very strong statement. And the other judges supported her, which was a very good thing, saying that the High Court was ashamed that this had happened. And the importance of that is, first of all, it demonstrated that they believed what the women said. And that's always so important when people make allegations. And secondly, that they apologised. And so for those women, sadly, as you just mentioned, I think one has left the profession. But for those women who no doubt have been affected by this all their lives, it would have meant a great deal.
I know you weren't 70 when you retired,
no, sorry.
But you were able to retire. I think there's some, you have to serve a certain number of years and be 60 perhaps before you can retire.
That's right.
So you took early retirement.
Yes.
There's quite a lot of literature now being written about babies that are born now are very like all things being equal. If they're born into a Western country, they have good nutrition, et cetera, et cetera, that they're likely to live to 100. And I see this as encouraging because it means that there's time to invest in different chapters of your life, rather than feeling that you have to achieve everything by the age of 40 and therefore maybe compromise on having a family or a stable relationship, whatever, that you've either got to put all your eggs in one basket. And it's fascinating to me. What's your sense of retiring when you did?
I retired because I felt that I'd had enough of doing what I had done for the last 22 or whatever years it was, and that I didn't feel I had much more to contribute at the family court. Also, the court was going through a very difficult time, and I don't want to sound like I was abandoning ship, but I really didn't think there was much I could do about it. And I really thought that...
So difficult time in what sense?
Oh, a complete lack of support by government, not enough judges to do the work, legislation that needed to be changed, reports were written but just ignored by successive governments, not enough funding, lack of leadership, all sorts of problems. The court was really in a very bad way.
Why do you think it is that the court wouldn't want to invest in an outstanding family court resolution system? I mean, don't any of them ever get divorced?
It's really a government problem. No governments have ever invested enough money in family law. They don't see much return for their money in family law. I also thought that if I left at that age, at 62 then, it would be possible for me to do something else. So I agree with what you say. It's not necessary to think, well, if I've got to achieve everything I'm going to achieve in my whole life by the time I'm 40, because that's it, I won't get another go at it. I don't think that's true.
No. Well, you've just begun another career.
Yes, as a mediator.
So what does that involve, Michelle?
It really means talking to people who've got, I only do property disputes. Occasionally I talk to people about their children, but it's mostly property disputes.
So in the area of family law.
Only in the area of family law. Yes, and helping people to resolve their disputes. And I really get a great deal of pleasure from it, because I know that if people don't resolve their dispute, they will have to wait at least 2 years to get a judgment. It will cost them a great deal of money.
So it's, I suppose, bringing all your expertise and experience to bear. I mean, they're lucky to have you, quite frankly.
Oh, it's very nice of you to say so. I think it is important. I think mostly people do trust me. They think that their solicitors would have said to them, you've got to listen to what I say. I'm going to be impartial, but I'll tell them quite clearly what I think about where they're heading in the settlement. It's not my job to give them legal advice, but it's certainly my job to try and help them resolve their disputes.
Michelle's observations from her novel vantage point at the family court bench about why some prosper in marriage and relationships while others make irredeemable mistakes, often with the result of sabotaging their future, were frank and sincere. This is advice directly from Australia's battlefield of custody, property and power plays. In 40 years, Michelle has seen it every which way. There can be no absolutes in the world of personal relationships, of course. However, education and qualifications that you can fall back on, maintaining a degree of independence and your own identity, insisting on the ability to make well-informed joint financial decisions, and preserving your ability to change course early if you think you've made a poor choice, all help to steady the balance of power and control within a relationship and minimise the likelihood of a protracted joust in the courts later on. I want to stress, as Michelle did, that financial literacy and participation in discussions that affect your financial future are fundamental at work too. In the past, it's true that women shied away from talking about money, but you only have to listen to Michelle for a moment to know that that head-in-the-sand approach hasn't served them well. These days, because in the spotlight, it makes no sense not to do the research so that you can speak up for yourself on the money front. Michelle had her own pause 3 or so years ago, deciding to leave the court and set up a private mediation practice well before the mandatory retirement age of 70. She still had time to offer something that was challenging to her, extremely marketable, and could achieve results without the drama, stress, delays, and combativeness of a courtroom campaign. It seems it's never too late to take stock and regroup. It's been an inspiration to talk to Michelle, whom I've known for nearly all of her working life. In all that time, she's had 1 year off, raised 3 brilliant women to adulthood, and managed to stay happily married, surrounded always by friends, family and dogs. I'm full of admiration. Leonie Marsh produced this episode. Jason Milhouse recorded Michelle and me in his own studio, a first for this year, and Lana Christensen did the sound edit. Thanks also to Claudia Cameron, who helps me, often at very short notice, with extra research. Please share a link to the episode with a friend if you think they'll find it helpful. And if you'd like to know more about Michelle, go to unpaused.net. I'm Judy Stewart. Until next time on Unpaused, farewell.